This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
I'm Beth Brown, and this is a story of my very own called Death Row Christmas. 3 years ago, I volunteered to be a pen pal to a man on death row. My pen pal's name is Rico, and I was told that he loves airplanes, which gave me something to write him about. I have always loved to fly and even worked as an aerial photographer, so I told him about that. He wrote back right away, and I was impressed with his neat handwriting and his skill in storytelling. We hit it off right away. He did not sound scary at all. I decided to go visit. It was very scary to think about visiting Central Prison, with its high wall topped with curly razor wire, and the guard towers with armed guards, and death row no less. These were the worst of the worst from all over the state. But Rico sounded so sweet, and I was very curious to see what it was like inside. Once I got used to the bars and thick, reinforced window between us, I found Rico a charming conversationalist. I have never gotten used to the horrible metal stools, but Rico has gotten used to my fiddling around to get more comfortable and doesn't seem to mind. I am his only visitor. Like most of the inmates at Central Prison, Rico is black and grew up in the projects. His mother is in poor health and lives in Charlotte, 3 hours away. His children, now in their teens, have grown up without him and live in Charlotte with their mother. Visiting hours are only on Wednesdays and Fridays, during school and working hours, making it difficult for most people to visit. I feel fortunate to have been able to visit him. He reads the newspaper every day and devours whatever magazines his fellow inmates receive, and he usually knows much more about current events than I do. He wants to know what is going on in my life, and once told me that I bring him life with my own. It's hard to imagine what life must be like for these guys. They have no money unless someone sends them some. Rico has to buy writing paper and envelopes and stamps if he wants to write a letter. He also has to buy a razor if he wants to shave. If he gets in a fight, no matter who starts it, he might get fined, for which he has to pay. If I want to send him a book, it has to come from the publisher. There is little else I could send him that he would be allowed to keep. He's only allowed to have one pair of shoes, one shirt, and one pair of pants. I think he's allowed two pairs of socks. Over this, he wears a bright red jumpsuit, the mark of those on death row. If the outside temperature is below 32 degrees, they are not allowed to go outside. None of them have coats. Rico has been on death row for 15 years, maintaining his innocence the entire time. He refuses to take a prison job because he feels his imprisonment is unjust. I'm amazed by his strength and spirit. It terrifies me that he could one day be put to death for something he didn't do. Just before Christmas, I visited him, and he told me a story. When he was incarcerated in 1997, it was prison policy to allow family members to send care packages of special foods to inmates at Christmas time. Unfortunately, the job of sorting out all the contraband from the gingerbread cookies and fruitcake became too big a job for the prison mailroom, and the policy was revoked the following year. After that, the prison contracted with a private company that accepted orders from family members and packaged up the treats to send to the inmates. Rico said that normally he would fill out an order form and send it to his mother and grandmother, who would submit it with payment. This year he decided to give the order to his attorneys to forward on to his mother and grandmother, probably because he had no money for postage. He hasn't written me in some time. When the packages arrived, the guys all waited expectantly as their names were called. All the packages were distributed, but a few guys, Rico among them, had no packages. They were assured that more were coming in a few days. That day arrived, and the rest of the guys got their packages, but there was no package for Rico. I can't imagine how he must have felt walking out of that room empty-handed. That night, when he got back to his cell after dinner, there was a tin of oysters on his bed. Later, a chocolate bar and a candy cane appeared. Over the next couple of days, items kept appearing. All the guys on death row contributed something. Rico had more treats than anyone. When he told me this story, he said he wanted to tell me about the goodness of people. I thought he was going to tell me that his attorneys made up for it by doing something nice, or that he had gotten something he had wanted even more. I didn't imagine that these convicted criminals would take pity on a fellow inmate and give away their few precious treats at Christmas. But it seems that even if you've done something bad, you can still do something good.
Christmas traditions. When was the first Christmas card sent? Why do we kiss under the mistletoe? This is Bill McKee, bringing you fun facts about some of our favorite Christmas traditions and symbols, courtesy of allthingschristmas.com. Mistletoe. Mistletoe was used by Druid priests 200 years before the birth of Christ in their winter celebrations. They revered the plant since it had no roots yet remained green during the cold months of winter. The ancient Celtics believed mistletoe to have magical healing powers and used it as an antidote for poison, infertility, and to ward off evil spirits. The plant was also seen as a symbol of peace, and it is said that among Romans, enemies who met under mistletoe would lay down their weapons and embrace. Scandinavians associated the plants with Frigga, their goddess of love, and it may be from this that we derive the custom of kissing under the mistletoe. Those who kiss under the mistletoe have the promise of happiness and good luck in the following year. The candy cane. It was not long after Europeans began using Christmas trees that special decorations were used to adorn them. Food items such as candies and cookies were used predominantly, and straight white candy sticks were one of the confections used as ornamentation. Legend has it that during the 17th century, craftsmen created the white sticks of candy in the shape of a shepherd's crook at the suggestion of the choir master at the Cologne Cathedral in Germany. The candy treats were given to children to keep them quiet during ceremonies at the living creche or nativity scene, and the custom of passing out the candy crooks at such ceremonies soon spread throughout Europe. According to the National Confectioners Association, in 1847, German immigrant August Imgard used the candy cane to decorate a Christmas tree in Wooster, Ohio. More than 50 years later, Bob McCormick of Albany, Georgia, supposedly made candy canes as treats for family, friends, and local shopkeepers. McCormick's brother-in-law, Catholic priest Gregory Keller. More recent explanations of the candy cane symbolism hold that the color white represents Christ's purity, the red the blood he shed, and the presence of the three red stripes, the Holy Trinity. While factual evidence for these notions does not exist, they have become increasingly common and at times are even represented as fact. Regardless, the candy cane remains a favorite holiday treat and decoration. Poinsettias. A native Mexican plant, poinsettias were named after Joel R. Poinsett, U.S. ambassador to Mexico, who brought the plant to America in 1828. Poinsettias were likely used by Mexican Franciscans in their 17th century Christmas celebrations. One legend has it that a young Mexican boy, on his way to visit the village nativity scene, realized he had no gift for the Christ child. He gathered pretty green branches from along the road and brought them to the church. Though the other children mocked him, when the leaves were laid at the manger, a beautiful star-shaped flower appeared on each branch. The bright red petals, often mistaken for flowers, are actually the upper leaves of the plant. Rudolph
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The Chicago-based Montgomery Ward department store operators had been purchasing and distributing children's coloring books as Christmas gifts for their customers for several years. In 1939, Montgomery Ward tapped one of their own employees to create a book for them, thus saving money. 34-year-old copywriter Robert L. May wrote the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in 1939, and 2.4 million copies were handed out that year. Despite the wartime paper shortage, over 6 million copies had been distributed by 1946. May drew in part on the story The Ugly Duckling, and in part from his own experiences as an often taunted, small, frail youth to create the story of the misfit reindeer. Though Rollo and Reginald were considered, May settled on Rudolph as his reindeer's name. Writing in verse as a series of rhyming couplets, May tested the story as he went along on his 4-year-old daughter Barbara, who loved the story. Sadly, Robert May's wife died around the time he was creating Rudolph, leaving May deeply in debt due to medical bills. However, he was able to persuade Sewell Avery, Montgomery Ward's corporate president, to turn the copyright over to him in January of 1947, thus ensuring May's financial security. May's story, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, was printed commercially in 1947, and in 1948 a 9-minute cartoon of the story was shown in theaters. When May's brother-in-law, songwriter Johnny Marks, wrote the lyrics and melody for the song, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the Rudolph phenomenon was born. Turned down by many musical artists, afraid to contend with the legend of Santa Claus, the song was recorded by Gene Autry in 1949 at the urging of Autry's wife. The song sold 2 million copies that year, going on to become one of the best-selling songs of all time, second only to Bing Crosby's White Christmas. The 1964 television special about Rudolph, narrated by Burl Ives, remains a holiday favorite to this day, and Rudolph himself has become a much-loved Christmas icon.
My name is George Kaiser, and my story will be Joseph's monologue. I am Joseph, and I am a common man. I am poor, but honest. I work with an axe, a hammer, a saw, and a drawshave. I know the difference between cedar, as well as eucalyptus and fir, and I also know what wood is good for what use. I live with sawdust in my hair and sweat on my face, but that is the way of life for me. I have also been a confused man, and perhaps even an angry man. Now some of you probably already know why. The Lord Almighty Himself came into my simple life and made it complicated. The Lord God invaded my privacy, interrupted my plans, and interfered with my marriage. But I suppose that is the way of life for me. And all of that started just because I fell in love, and I'm still very much in love, with Mary. Mary, wife of Joseph. I guess it was her eyes that first captured me. How could it be anything else? Her eyes were not like other eyes I'd seen. Her eyes could dance. Her eyes were so deep. They were like dark passageways leading to a mystery that I had to explore. Mary was also quite young, just as all Jewish brides in my world were young. But she liked me well enough, and her father was willing, and I could afford the dowry. So we were betrothed. Betrothal is very official and legal. It can go on for a year before the wedding. It is also a good preparation for marriage. There is a broken axe handle on my bench that can tell you how I felt when Mary came to me one day and said, Joseph, I must tell you something. And I smiled, because I always smile when Mary comes near. Tell me, my darling. Tell me what has brought you here. Tell me why your eyes are not dancing today. Tell me what's on your heart.
Joseph, she said, and she choked with some sort of emotion that was hidden from me. Joseph, I'm going to have a child. Oh, I know that, my love, I know. Surely you will have a child. Yes, of course, we will have many children together. No, Joseph, no. You don't understand. I am going to have a child. I'm with child now, Joseph. I began at this point hearing a steady hum in my ears, and my face grew just all red and hot, and I could barely stand. I could hardly even speak. Mary, what are you saying? Mary, how can this be? And suddenly at this point, all the sawdust on the floor found its way into my stomach, and a hammer kept pounding inside my head, and an awl twisted into my heart. Mary was still talking, of course, trying to explain. But it was a long time before I could even hear or understand what she was saying. She kept talking about God. That, yes, she was with child, but no, she had not been unfaithful. How could that be? Yes, she was still pure, but no, it was not impossible because the signs were there. She knew she was with child and expecting a baby, and God had brought this upon her. God was the Father. Let me ask you something. Would you believe a story like that? Would that story bring comfort to your heart? Would it answer your questions? The story she told was strange from beginning to end. An angel of the Lord came and spoke to her. The Holy Spirit of God overshadowed her, and a child was conceived within her. A holy child. A male child. A child who would one day become the Messiah of God, sent to redeem all people. Oh, yes. Of course. That is such an obvious explanation. And my sawhorses can pull a plow. Now, I am a simple man, but I am not simple-minded. How could she expect me to believe a story like that? And what did she even expect me to do? Well, I know what I intended to do. I intended to get a quiet divorce, take her away to another town where she could have the baby in peace. I don't know how Mary could do this to me, but I did not wish to bring shame upon her, or worse, the possibility of stoning by making the matter public. When Mary left, her eyes were swimming, and the front of her robe was all spattered with tears, and I could see the disappointment in her eyes when she knew that I doubted her. I could also see the fear and the hurt within her eyes when she thought that I would take her away to another town and leave her there. There were tears on my tunic, too. But what did she expect me to do? Did she expect me to believe that she was carrying a child conceived by the Spirit of God? Go home, Mary. Just go home. I need time to think about this. Yes, I still love you. I think. I just need to think. Mary. Mary, this is not the way that life is supposed to be. I will talk to you again tomorrow. Goodbye, Mary. Let me think. Let me think. I had to think thoughts that no one has ever had to think of before. Now, if Mary was lying with this amazing story, then I was just one more betrayed man. But if she was telling the truth, if Mary was telling the truth, then the fate of the Lord's Messiah rests in my hands, The burden and responsibility was on my shoulders. Would I give him a name? A family? A home? Or would I leave him quietly in another town? Now, these were thoughts that I never, ever intended to think. But I thought them throughout the day and into the night, until they finally chased me into sleep. I expected bad dreams, I guess. But the dream that I had was beyond just bad or good. It was beyond anything that I could put a name on, because it came from the world beyond my experience. An angel of the Lord came to me. An angel came to me and called my name. Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived within her is indeed of the Holy Spirit, and she will bear a son, and you shall call him Jesus. For it is he who shall redeem his people from their sins. And then he was gone. Just like that. Gone. No time for questions. No time for even explanations. Just a simple message from God that Mary's tall tale was in fact the truth. I did not understand. I did not ask for this. But I chose to obey. Because that is what my faith, as well as my heart, told me to do. We are all called to trust and obey, even when we do not understand. For that's the way life is. So, I took Mary as my wife, and I lived with, but also apart from her, all those many months until the child was born. It was one night while we were in Bethlehem for a Roman census. That's the night that you remember. The night I led the donkey into town. The night that I could not find poor Mary a decent room, and the night that I stood quietly by while the Son of God was born to my wife. Now for you, the story of Christmas is just that. Shepherds kneeling, angels singing, and Joseph standing silently in the corner while radiant light beams from the manger scene. Now for me, Christmas is far more than just that first night in Bethlehem. But still, I will never forget that corner. I would not have been anywhere else. There was a light born in Bethlehem's stable that night, a light that stole my heart and quickened my soul. Neither Mary nor I ever understood the kind of Messiah Jesus was born to be, and we struggle with that throughout our lives, to come to terms with what it meant to be the parents of God's child, guardians of the light of the world. This is the truth and the judgment. The light of God has come into the world, even though human beings continue to love the darkness more than the light. Yet the light of God's Son shines brightly still, blazing a bright path into the future, beckoning all to follow. Even now, he calls you to follow. Even now, he calls you to come and stand in the corner with me, to behold his light, the light of truth, the light of life, and the light of love. Take hold of this light and share it with others, so they too will find their way. Find their way out of the darkness and into the light.
Hello, I'm Pamela Smith. I'll be reading from Chicken Soup for the Soul, the Book of Christmas Virtues. The first tale is titled Charlie's Coat. It was written by Robin Sylphane Stewart. She'd been on a half-hearted hunt for some misplaced Christmas stockings when she found the coat. Warm and soft, brown and dear, in the very back of her bedroom closet, hiding behind a big box of Glenn Miller albums. The sight of it shocked, surprised, and saddened her. All three emotions gathered in one scary lump in the space between her throat and her permanently broken heart. Why hadn't she found it before? Charlie had been gone a year to the day, and she had been in that closet countless times. She'd pilfered through it like a teary-eyed madwoman, looking for bits and pieces of the man she loved all of her life. Things that were his, things he had worn. Faded flannel shirts, his second skin from September through every April. Broken in Levi's with permanent white creases, sharp enough to slice a loaf of homemade bread. And his shoes, oh God, the shoes. Empty shoes, just sitting there all alone. Except for the coat, they were the hardest things to look at. Reebok Walkers, white on white, his old standbys. She bought them just 2 weeks before he passed away. Where was that man who filled those shoes? Not here. Not sitting with her on the side of the bed. Not out in the wood shop. Not at the corner takeout. Not gawking at the fence with the neighbors. Not dangling a grandkid on his knee. Not here in this house, where he belonged. Ginny made herself stand, take two small steps, and with eyes closed, reached to the back of the closet. There, she thought. She felt it. See? She could feel that coat and not go to pieces. But could she hold it? Asked a small inner voice. Could she smell it? Look at it? And while she wondered, it hit her again. How did it get here, and where it had been for a long, whole year? She told the kid she wanted it back. She didn't care which one of them had taken it. She knew it was out of love that they conspired to hide it away, like a piece of hurt she wouldn't have to see. She knew, out of sight, out of mind. But they had insisted, all three of them, that they did not hide the coat, the chocolate brown barn coat she had given him their first Christmas, 1962, the one he wore to work every day for the next 25 years, the one she'd teasingly threatened to toss away when the pockets wore off and the deep ribs became smooth and dull and the points on the collar curled up. The one he insisted on keeping long after it was presentable. In less than a breath, she reached up now on her toes and tugged at the coat with all the loneliness and despair and gut-wrenching longing that was in her. And just as suddenly, with great care and respect and love, she pulled it to her small, shaking frame and slipped it on, one arm at a time, until she could double the breast, and then held on tight and remembered. A beautiful lady I knew bought it for me, he had said, and I'm not about to give it up. She still remembered the pain and the pride she felt when he said that, looking at her like she was the best thing he could ever hope to possess, and she understood. He most certainly had been the finest thing she had ever known. And oh, that did it. That single, long-ago moment broke the dam. Just his quiet words. It was the first time in my life, Ginny, that anyone ever loved me enough to buy me a new coat, a brand new coat. Thank you for that, for loving me like that. And after the horrible pangs of his sudden death, she searched for it everywhere. She had torn the house up looking for it and hadn't been able to find it. But now here it was, 1 year later, wrapped all around her. The snow was falling, the Christmas bells were ringing, it was growing dark, and here it was. Ginny pulled the coat tighter and bent her face to the collar. She breathed in and found the scent of pine wood chips, English leather, good strong coffee, and Charlie. She took another deep, deep breath from way, way down, and every moment she ever shared with him flashed before her mind and her heart, and she snuggled even further into the warmth. Oh, yes, she loved him that Christmas so long ago, and all the Christmases in between. And she loved him still this Christmas, when there was nothing left of him except the memories and his old brown coat. Our next story is titled Surprise Santa by Henry Boy. A few days before Christmas, a devout Christian couple held the hands of their young son and walked briskly to their nearby church. But the boy pulled back a bit, slowed, and came to an abrupt halt. "Santa," he whispered, "Santa." The four-year-old broke free of his parents' grasp and ran toward an elderly gentleman with a long, flowing white beard. Tugging on the stranger's coattail, the youngster begged, "Santa, will you bring me a teddy bear for Christmas?" Embarrassed, the couple started to apologize, but the man merely waved them aside. Instead, he patted their son on the head, nodded once, winked wryly at the youngster, and, without a word, went on his way. On Christmas morning, a knock interrupted the family's festivities. In the doorway stood the old man, holding out a large bear with a plaid bow around its neck. "I didn't want the little fellow to be disappointed on this holiday," he explained with an awkward grimace, and turned to leave. Uncomfortable and stunned, the parents could only stutter a weak, thanks, and Merry Christmas to you, Rabbi."
This is Laura Arwood, and I have something a little different. It's a science fiction Christmas story by John Christopher called Christmas Roses, first published in 1943. The skipper cushioned us in nicely. I had my eyes on the dial the whole time, and the needle never got above 4.5 G's. With a boat like the Arkland, that was good. I've known a bad pilot touch 7 G's on an Earth landing. All the same, I didn't feel so hot. Young Stenway was out of his cradle before the tremors had stopped. I lay still a moment while he stood over me grinning. He said, "Break it up, Joe, dreaming of a pension?" I got up with a bounce and landed him a playful clip that rocked him back into his own cradle. There was normal gravity underneath us. The feeling of rightness you know in your bones and muscles, no matter how long you've been away. It was good to feel myself tough, though. Stenway said, "So this is Washington. What day is it?" I said, "You revert to type quick, kid. How should I know what day it is? I'm only a visitor." He grinned, flushing a little, and went over to the multiple calendar. I saw him fingering it, his face screwed up. He said, "Friday. Say, Joe, if we take more than 14 days on the turnaround, we'll make Christmas here." I said, If we take more than 10 days on the turnaround, the whole board of directors will commit gory suicide. What's worrying you? You'll get Plum Duff in Luna City. He grinned lopsidedly and went out in a hurry. I was a bit sorry for him. He'd done less than a year in the service. Things weren't the right pattern for him yet. He probably thought some of us were tough eggs, but we had to ride him down now and then for his own good. I went along to see Louis. He had been in space only a couple of years less than I had, and we'd both been with the Arkland since she was commissioned 8 years before. But we didn't see each other much, working on different shifts and pretty nearly at opposite ends of the boat. I found him in the mess, sprucing up. He said, "Hello, Joe, you still with us?" I said, "Why not? I'm only young once." "Borrowed time," he said. "Just borrowed time." I said, "Louis, do me a favor." He said, "Any little thing." He put down a hairbrush and started powdering his face, overlaying the finely raveled seams of red that told he had been out in vacuum. I couldn't understand that myself. It made you a bit unusual on Earth. It stamped you as a spaceman. But heck, who would be ashamed of that? Still, I've never been branded myself, so maybe I shouldn't talk. I said, "You're handling the loading for the next trip?" He pressed the powder in with his fingertips and nodded. "I want to get something on board," I said. "How big?" he asked. I shrugged lightly. "About 5 feet long, maybe 3 feet across each way at its widest, but it will squeeze a bit." Louis jutted his chin out and flicked a patch of black velvet across his face. He spoke through his teeth. "What about the Pentagon building, if you want a souvenir?" I said, "What would I do with the Pentagon building?" Louis turned around. "Look, Joe, you know how things are. You know the cost of space freighting. There isn't a quarter ounce of cargo weight that isn't accounted for. What do you want to fit in anyway?" "It's for old Hans," I told him. "I thought of taking him a Christmas tree." Louis didn't say anything for a moment. He had brushed the powder well in, but you could still see the crimson network underneath. At last, he said, "Okay, get it up here the night before we blast. I'll fix it for you." I said, "Thanks, Louis. When will that be, by the way? Have they told you?" 19th, he said. "Now go and raise hell for 9 days. Don't forget the medical tomorrow." I looked at him sharply, but he was brushing another layer of powder in. Medical was a routine always taken between 18 and 24 hours after cushioning. The doctors knew why, or they said they did. It wasn't the sort of thing you needed to be reminded of, but it wasn't worth taking him up on it. The Arkland touched at Washington every 5th trip. I knew quite a few numbers, and I went all out to raise my usual cane. There was a somber moment once when one of the girls relaxed and the wrinkles stood out, but it passed. There was always the younger generation. I let it get round to 2 days from blasting before I dropped in on the company's office. They've got a block of masonry on Roosevelt Boulevard that's bigger than Luna City. Welfare is on floor 32. It makes me airsick to look out of their windows. There was a little blonde at the desk. She said hello very brightly. It occurred to me that next time I might contact welfare at the beginning of a furlough. She looked as though she could get through my back pay as well as any. I said, "You can help me out. I want to buy something." She was restrained but eager. I said, "Yeah, I want to buy a Christmas tree." She looked surprised and rather disappointed, but she was businesslike. She waded through a pile of directories like a terrier after rats. "Christmas trees," she said. "Your best bet is Lee Cliff Nursery's Mr. Cliff. About 15 miles out, you can pick up a gyro on the roof. I said, don't tell me there's a roof on this thing. She smiled very nicely. I said, keep a week free next November. I'll be back. The gyro did the trip in just over 10 minutes. Where it put me down, you wouldn't guess such a place as Washington existed. One way there were a lot of low sheds and a few glass houses. The other way there were just fields and fields of plants growing. I realized that it was more than 10 years since I'd been outside a city on Earth, furlough. You get into habits. It occurred to me that I might have been missing something. They phoned Mr. Cliff that I was coming. Good service is the company's motto. He was waiting when the gyro touched. A little round fellow with a look as though something had surprised him. He said, Major Davies, I'm delighted to see you. We don't see many spacemen out here. Come and see my roses. He seemed eager, and I let him take me. I wasn't breaking my neck to get back into town. He had a glass house full of roses. I hesitated in the doorway. Mr. Cliff said, well? I'd forgotten they smelled like that, I said. He said proudly, it's quite a showing, a week before Christmas, and a showing like that. Look at this Frau Karl Druski. It was a white rose, very nicely shaped, and scented like spring. The roses had me. I crawled round after Mr. Cliff, seeing roses, feeling roses, breathing roses. I looked at my watch when it began to get dark. I said, I came to buy a Christmas tree. We left the Rose House reluctantly. Mr. Cliff said, Christmas on Earth for a change? I liked Mr. Cliff. I said, no, Luna City. It's for someone there. He waited for me to go on. A guy called Hans. I said, he's been nearly 40 years in Luna City. He was born in a little village in Austria, halfway up a mountain with pines all around and snow on them in winter. You know, he gets homesick. Mr. Cliff said, why doesn't he come back? It's always a shock when people show how little they know about the life you lead, though I suppose I can't blame them. I said to Mr. Cliff, the doctors have it all tabbed. It's what they call cumulative stress. You can't bring a boat in or push her off without an initial strain. It varies with the planets, of course. For Earth, with an average-sized vessel, the peak's about 5 or 6 gravities. I flexed my shoulders back, breathing this different air. You've got to be tough physically, I said. But even so, it tells. It's the heart, chiefly. They give you a warning when it begins to flicker. You can drop out then with a pension. Of course, there are some who carry on. They're used to the life and... And? Said Mr. Cliff. There's a final warning as well. They check up on you after each trip, vet you for the next. Then, one time, it's just a plain no. You can argue, but the answer's no. Another takeoff would finish you. So they say, there's no way of testing it. They just don't let you on a boat after that. Mr. Cliff said, they're very considerate. I laughed. Oh, very. The only thing is, they check you each landfall. Hans got his final warning at Luna City. Mr. Cliff said, oh. He bent his head to smell the red rose in his coat. How long ago did you say? Hans is an old man, over 70. Generally, you get your first warning when you're about 30. Nearly enough 40 years, I suppose. And how big is this Luna City? That's easy, I said. It's in the guidebooks. A couple of blocks long by a block wide. It goes underground a bit as well. That's terrible, Mr. Cliff said softly. 40 years like that. No trees, no birds. And young men know that and still take the risk? I can't believe it. It was an old story, but I'd never felt myself getting so mad about it before. I reined myself in. He was a nice old guy. I said, "You don't understand, Mr. Cliff. There's something in the life. And sometimes there's more than 5 years between first and final warnings. One guy went 10. There's always one more trip that's worth making before you settle down for good. They don't recruit spacemen who give up easily. And you may always strike lucky and get your ticket at this end." He said gently, "When did you get your first warning, Major Davies?" I flushed. 3 years ago. "So what? Now, this matter of the Christmas tree, Mr. Cliff." Mr. Cliff said, "I'll show you. The Christmas tree is on me. Please, I want to." I said, "Thanks, Mr. Cliff. For Hans, too." "I own some stock in lunar mines," he blinked. 40 years. He led me away to show me the fir trees, and the scent of roses gave way to a rich, piney smell that made me remember being a kid and holidays up in the lakes. He said, "I've been thinking, Major Davies, I've got a proposition that may interest you." I didn't see Louis when the tree went on board. One of his boys handled it. There wasn't a sign of any of the company police around, and I guess Louis was distracting them down at the night office in a friendly game of poker. Skinning them, too, if I knew Louis. I didn't see him until the end of my second shift on the trip. The radar screen was a beautiful blank. It was a clear season for meteors. Louis was lolling in front of it reading The Three Musketeers. I said, "I always knew I slipped up when I majored in nav. Do they pay you for this?" Sometimes there's ill feeling about the large stretches of easy time radar ops manages to corner. But Louis knew I'd been in space too long for that. Until the automatic relay smartened up a lot, there's got to be a man at the screen. And the company doesn't give time away. The radar section handled the quartermastering, too. Every third furlough, they lose 2 days. Louis grinned. "I've got a weak heart. Didn't you know?" I tossed him a cigarette. "Thanks for getting baby on board. What did you throw out? Gold bars?" He shook his head. "Just my own brand of math. If that orbit you've laid us turns out bad enough, we'll hit the sun approximately 10 minutes sooner than we would otherwise. And I've got to pep my meteor deflection up by 3/1000ths of a second. It's a big risk." "My orbit's good," I said. "I'll only ever lay one better. Next trip, I'm going to lay the tightest moon-Earth orbit since Christensen came in on the Leonids. After that, you needn't worry about my failing eyes, Louis." He said, "I'm glad, Joe. I always knew you had sense. I'm dropping out the moment they give me a hint. It's not worth it." I said, "Yes, I'm really going." Louis said, "You'll miss it, but you'll get over that. You would have to, anyway, before long." I said, "It's out in the country, Louis, a nursery, growing plants, all kinds of plants. Fir trees and chrysanthemums and daffodils and roses at Christmas. And the moon's no more than something you plant by. I shan't miss anything." He said, "You're lucky, Joe. That's what it is. You're lucky." We cushioned at 3 G's, and I felt it again, a long ache inside my chest, as though my heart and lungs were tied up with strings and someone was twisting them nice and slowly. It was all right after a few minutes, and I got up, light and active under moon gravity. I wasted no time getting through the main lock. I looked for old Hans among those who stood by, but there was no sign of him. I called Portuguese, who runs the grog shop. Portuguese, where's Hans? I've got something for him. He came waddling over airily. With a bulk like his, I could almost understand why he had chosen Luna City. He shrugged, lifting everything, hands, shoulders, and eyebrows. Too late now, he said. He died just after nightfall. We're taking him out in a few hours. In Luna City, there are no extras. You don't waste anything that has to be freighted a quarter of a million miles, and that includes oxygen. When men die there, their bodies are kept until nightfall, when, for 336 hours, darkness freezes into rime the last traces of the moon's atmosphere. Sometime during the night, the body is taken out in a caterpillar and committed with duly economical rites to some cleft in the antique rocks. With the sunrise and the thin air melts, the gray lichen runs like a sickness along the crater bottoms. And in that jungle, the minute lunar insects awaken to fight battles as real as Tyrannosaurus ever knew. Long before the crater shadows lengthen towards sunset, the cleft is empty again. No flesh, no hair, no scrape of bone escapes them. Portuguese drove the caterpillar out through the airlock. Louis and I sat behind him with old Han's body, covered by a sheet on the floor between us. We were silent while the little truck jolted on its metal tracks across granite and pumice and frozen lava. And I don't think it was the death inside that silenced us. We had liked old Hans, but he had had his time and was released now to infinity from the narrow confines of Luna City. It was the death outside that quietened us, as it quietens any man who goes out among those age-old crests and pinnacles, under those glaring stars. Portuguese halted the caterpillar on the crest of a rise about midway between Luna City and Kelly's crater. It was an unusual burial ground. The planet's surface here was crosshatched in deep grooves by some age-old catastrophe. We clamped down the visors on our suits and got out. Portuguese and I carried old Hans easily between us, his frail body fantastically light against lunar gravity. We put him down carefully in a wide, deep cleft, and I turned round towards the truck. Louis walked towards us, carrying the Christmas tree. There had been moisture on it, which had frozen instantly into sparkling frost. It looked like a centerpiece out of a store shop window. It seemed a good idea back in Luna City, but now it didn't seem appropriate. We wedged it in with rocks. Portuguese read a prayer, and we walked back to the caterpillar, glad to be able to let our visors down again and light up cigarettes. We stayed there while we smoked, looking through the front screen. The tree stood up green and white against the sullen, hunching blackness of Kelly's crater. Right overhead was the earth, glowing with daylight. I could make out Italy, clear and unsmudged. But further north, Hans' beloved Austria was hidden under blotchy December's cloud. We didn't say anything. Portuguese squeezed out his cigarette and started the caterpillar up, turning her round again towards Luna City. We ran into B block and Portuguese stabled the truck and came out again to join us. He put his fat arms around our shoulders. Come on, boys. Always a drink on the house after a burying party. Louis said, Medical first, Portuguese. We'll look in afterwards. Keep the rum hot for us. We saw him glide plumply away and turned back ourselves towards the admin buildings. The others had been through the medical while we were out, and we had a doctor each without any waiting. We sat in the anteroom afterwards, waiting for them to write up our cards before we could collect them. At last the call came through the speaker. Major Graves, Squadron Enderby, cards ready now. Louis got his first. He looked at the big blue stamp on the front. First warning. He grinned. We'll go out in harness, Joe. any chance of a third partnership in that flower business? I didn't say anything. I could see my card before the doctor gave it to me. I saw the red star splashed on it, and I'd seen too many of them not to know what it meant. It was the mark of the exile, the outlaw who left it too late to get back. It was the beginning of such a story as the one whose end, 40 years later, I had witnessed in the lee of Kelly's crater under the mocking globe of Earth. I said, "This is my last trip, Doc. When we hit Antwerp, I'm retiring." He shook his head. "I'm sorry, Major." I said, "I don't care if it's a million to one chance, Doc. I'll take it. And no hard feelings if it doesn't come off. I'll sign any disclaimer the company wants." He said, "It's no good, Major. You know the regulations. These things are too foolproof now. We're not going to allow you to commit suicide." I knew it was no good, too. Louis had gone. We all knew better than to stick around when someone got the red star. I had time to look at the doctor. He was very young and didn't look very happy. I guessed he hadn't handed out a star before. He said, "It could be worse, Major. It could have been Phobos." I looked at him and he looked away. I walked out slowly. From the top level in Luna City, you can see the sky. At night, the stars and the softly glowing Earth. Down to the west, Sirius blazes over Kelly's crater. I've been up there for hours watching them. I keep thinking I can smell roses.